Hello, and welcome to the Logistics Management Podcast Series. My name is Jeff Berman. I'm Group News Editor for Logistics Management Magazine and the Peerless Media Supply Chain Group. Today, it's a real pleasure to welcome Todd Tranowski to our podcast. Todd serves as Vice President, Rail and Intermodal for FTR Transportation Intelligence. FTR is a transportation forecasting firm. Todd joined FTR initially in 2018. Prior to that, he served as North American Transportation Editor for Argus Media, where he was responsible for overseeing the quality of Argus's existing transportation reports and also leading the company's product development in that area. Prior to being promoted in January 15, Todd was responsible for editing the weekly Argus Coal Transportation Newsletter, along with overseeing the Argus Rail Business publication that focuses on both rail and shipper dynamics, critical rate data, rail cost, and regulatory and operational issues within the rail industry. He also assessed rail and barge rates for the movement of petroleum products in the Argus Petroleum Transportation Report. Todd is a Philadelphia native and is a diehard Philadelphia sports fan, somewhat to my chagrin being a New York sports fan, but we'll get past that. Todd graduated from Temple University with dual degrees in both history and journalism, and he also worked as a sports reporter covering AA baseball down in New Jersey prior to joining Argus. Hey, Todd, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me, and I guess we won't talk about the miracle at the Meadowlands today.
No, we can stay clear of that. And I promise not to talk about the 2009 World Series.
But to
get things going, Todd, let's just start with the basics, sort of your sweet spot over at FTR, and that being really your expertise within the rail carload and intermodal markets. Let's start with the rail carload side. When we look at the numbers from the AAR, they're definitely still on a both weekly and monthly level. They're definitely still obviously well outpacing 2019 levels for a whole host of reasons. But we're also seeing a bit of pullback, I think, in recent weeks, too, although the numbers still do remain elevated. How do you sort of describe or assess what's happening when we look at carload?
Well, as you think about the carload market, carload is having its best year of the last three. And so if you're in the carload space, that's exciting, but it also depends on what part of the carload market you're in as to just how good those numbers are. As you start to peel back the onion a little bit, not all of the carload sectors are created equal. Metals, metallic ores have been a runaway winner. Mm-hmm. Grain was a runaway winner there for some time over the last couple of months. It has come down off of those heights, but it's still at five-year average levels, which are things that we haven't seen over the last couple of years because of trade overhangs and poor growing conditions. So overall, it's still a good news story. The chemical space has been going gangbusters. It took a little bit of a step back in the last couple of weeks, but overall, I'm not too concerned about it. As those folks try to make up the production they lost earlier this year in February and March after the Texas freeze.
Right.
Took time for those folks to get back online. I expect them to go flat out through the end of the year. But then you look at something like automotive and things are weak. Maybe not for a rail reason, but for a supply chain reason, not being able to get the chips that they need to be able to finish units and not be able to get some of the components they need. And so that commodity group, that sector, the automotive sector, has really sort of lagged over the last several months and will continue to do that until they get the chip situation and the other part situations sorted out. And you've had pulp and paper that's been a little bit of a laggard as you look at the forest product space. Lumber's held up pretty good. Primary forest products held up pretty good. Pulp and paper has lagged. It's come back a little bit lately, but overall it's been a little bit of a disappointing performance for that sector in the carload space. So it really does depend where you are in carload as to just how good it's been, even though overall carload, it is having a very good year.
Okay. Yeah, that's great. That's great to hear. And shifting gears, how about intermodal? I know that we've seen quite a few months over the last several, which have in fact been record-breaking as per AAR data, that is.
Yeah, intermodal has been going great guns. It really has since we've come out of the pandemic. The economy started to reopen, the middle of last year. Intermodal took off a lot quicker last year than Carlo did. It took Carlo a little bit of time to ramp up. Intermodal didn't do that. Intermodal just took off down the runway and has stayed at those levels basically ever since. When you look at import numbers, when you look at active truck utilization numbers, you know, there's no reason to think that intermodal is going to have a headwind anytime soon. There's plenty of supply in the system to support volumes. It's been a little bit interesting that since the Memorial Day holiday, we have sort of run right in the 360,000-365,000 carload a week range off of our highs from where we were up near 380,000-385,000 carloads a week prior to Memorial Day.
Right.
And we haven't ever gotten back there, even though there's plenty of pressure in the system. The May port data shows that there continues to be a high rate of imports through all of the port complexes in North America. It shows that there's demand in the system. You look at inventory levels across the system, they're exceedingly low. Active truck utilization at 100%. FTR's Intermodal Competitive Index, which measures how competitive intermodal is relative to domestic truckload, is in the positive double digits. So that says that intermodal has a clear competitive edge over the truckload market. So It's a little concerning that we haven't seen volumes go back to that 380,000-385,000 carload level. Though I think part of it is shippers are a little gun-shy. There have been widespread service issues, really not just intermodal but across the system. But intermodal has been more acutely affected than other groups across the network. And so I think we've seen some hesitancy from shippers to really commit to intermodal, to look for other ways to get capacity where they can. When you think about some of what we've read in the media, you know, with ramp closures and ramp embargoes in certain places on certain carriers, that makes it hard for shippers to commit to those lanes, to commit to those facilities, particularly when the whispers in the industry and in the media are that additional facilities could be affected as we move toward peak season, as we go through the next couple of months. And so You would expect to see intermodal volumes come back, particularly coming out of the July 4th holiday, heading toward peak season. If they don't, I think we need to look in as an intermodal industry and say, where is the bottleneck and why can't we capitalize on this? Why can't we get back to those levels and even exceed those levels, given the competitive structure, given the level of demand and level of freight in the system that wants to move?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And just as an aside, and we can get back to service in a second, Todd, do you think the truck capacity situation is weighing pretty heavily on intermodal as well, or is it more of a combo of truck capacity and just general rail service issues? What's happening there?
Well, I think folks are definitely looking for capacity any way they can get it. If they can avoid the rail service issues and get capacity in truckload, I think they would take it right now. The question is, can they get that capacity? When we look at active truck utilization, it's up near 100% and it's expected to stay there into early 2022. So I don't know that folks can necessarily get cost competitive capacity in the truckload market unless they really want to pay a premium for it, or they really want to go that route for some reason. If they've been alienated from a carrier, or if they've had detention, the marriage issues with a carrier, and they have to go to truck. But overall, I think folks would use intermodal if they could. But I think there's a question: when the truck market softens, will that intermodal volume stick around?
Yeah, absolutely. And the current state of truckload pricing it certainly presents challenges for shippers too, I'm sure. So there's that. So Todd, obviously a big topic of late has been the Canadian National Kansas City Southern developments in terms of the planned acquisition, and it's obviously for a hefty sum of money. It's creating a lot of interest among rail and intermodal stakeholders, to say the least. What's sort of your take on things as they presently stand, and in terms of potential outcomes too?
Well, I mean, I think it's an interesting transaction. I think it is a much more difficult road to regulatory approval than the other transaction that was contemplated, because the CPKCS transaction was going to use the exemption process and had been okayed to use the exemption process. That process would have essentially guaranteed that transaction's approval. And so this having to go under the new rules, which, let's be honest about the new rules. They were created in 2001 by then STB Chair Linda Morgan, with, if not the expressed intent, certainly the sense that the idea was to make these rules such that a major Class 1 merger would be very difficult, if not impossible, to approve. And so you have a backdrop where it is very difficult to meet that standard. And then you layer on recent developments in Washington, and it certainly encourages the board to be very skeptical of what is submitted in a consolidation proceeding, in a merger proceeding. And I think it makes a hard road even more difficult for those folks. Whatever you think about the transaction, whatever your thoughts are, whether it'd be good for the industry or pro-competitive or not, the fact is the rules that are in place were set up ostensibly to not allow Class 1 mergers. And when you have the recent news out of Washington, it doesn't help that any.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think that this could drag on a bit, or do you think we could have some sort of closure here, say by end of the calendar year?
I don't think it'll be end of calendar year. I think it will definitely drag into 2022. Mm-hmm. It's something that I think when you look at the timeline, I think it was going to be a next year issue. Either way, the folks went for approval, whether it was a CP transaction or a CN transaction, it was going to be a 2022 approval. But I really question, with the rules as they are, can any deal be approved under the standards that are out there? And does the board have the appetite to create a roadmap to approval through rules that were set up not to allow that approval?
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. And then shifting over to another rail theme, the one being of PSR, or precision scheduled railroading. Nearly all the Class 1s, if not all of them, I believe, have adopted it at this point. And how has the market reception been? Is it in line with how the rails view it? What's sort of going on there? It seemed like once the ball got rolling with PSR, it really picked up velocity as time went on, especially among the Class 1s.
No, I mean, there was certainly peer pressure, so to speak, to adopt it, particularly among the publicly owned Class 1 carriers. And I think we've seen that happen. Well, PSR, I mean, I think when you look at it, when you look at the service issues that we've had coming out of the pandemic, you know, what the industry was told when PSR was being implemented was that it'll make the railroads more able to handle fluctuations in volumes and make them more nimble and make them more efficient to be able to not have some of the issues that they've traditionally had when volumes fluctuate. Certainly, they were very good last year on the downside during the pandemic, taking capacity, taking assets and resources out of the system to match volume declines, and being very good and very efficient about it. On the upside here, what we've seen as rail service has sort of continued to languish and not recovered, I think that says that maybe on the upside, we as an industry, we haven't done as good a job as we could have, you know, managing demand and managing resources, and maybe we're not as efficient as we thought we were. Mm-hmm. Because we're still having these issues. I think I would have expected, and I think shippers would have expected as well, and I think privately, I think the carriers will tell you they expect it to be better than they are at the moment.
All right. Okay. You know, with the calendar by the day getting closer, now we're officially in mid-July, you know, everyone's got peak season on their minds, although people's concepts or or views of peak season in light of the pandemic have likely changed to varying degrees, with some people saying it's been peak season all the time, for example, going back to March 2020. But at the outset, which is when the pandemic obviously really came through in full force here in the States especially, but in a traditional sense, how should we be viewing or approaching or looking at peak season in terms of just 2021 from a market perspective? I know there's a lot to unpack there, given the port issues and labor issues. There's all these kinds of things that are related to it. So there's a lot going on there, to say the least, right?
No, there's certainly a lot going on as we get into the peak season. I think, from a rail perspective, if you're a shipper, if you're an intermodal shipper, I think you can expect to see sort of more of the same, which is congestion-related delays, which is difficulty getting goods in and out of ramps, having containers that aren't necessarily accessible to you when you expect them to be accessible to you. I think you're going to see all of that continue and potentially get worse as we add additional volumes to the system. Now, the question becomes, do other parts of the supply, do we see a worsening of port congestion? We've seen the media reports where the Port of Oakland particularly has gotten skipped by ocean carriers to try and bypass some of that congestion. Well, that puts additional volumes into other ports and puts volumes in other ports that maybe the beneficial cargo owners and the carriers weren't necessarily expecting to have to move at those other ports. And so I think to the extent that continues, you're going to see the congestion issues continue to be an issue for everybody, whether it's port, whether it's railroad, whether it's shipper. And we're going to, as an industry, have to figure out how to deal with these issues in a way so that folks know what their transit time is going to be. The number one thing that shippers talk about is that they want consistency. They don't care if intermodal is longer than truck, so long as it's a consistent supply chain time, so as long as it's a consistent delivery time, consistent transit times. But the carriers need to be able to deliver that. They need to be able to give shippers confidence that each and every time they move that container, it's going to be 7 days or 8 days. It's not going to be 14 and 6 and 14 and 18. And it needs to be consistent. And so I think the challenge for carriers is going to be this peak season, getting their trip plan compliance, getting their on-time percentage up to a level where shippers can count on it as they build their supply chains.
Yeah. Yeah. That consistency component that you noted is just huge. And especially in terms of supply chain efficiency, to say the least. Todd, last week, the White House issued an executive order focused on promoting competition within the American economy. And certainly getting a lot of attention, focused on various vertical markets within the economy, but for the areas in which we live in, freight rail and container shipping, we're certainly in the spotlight there. And while the executive order was, it covered all these industries, it was more of like an encouragement or sort of pointed advice towards both the freight rail and container shipping sectors. How do you sort of view what was directed there, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, it was worded more closely to a statement of administrative policy rather than an executive order, which for those of you who don't trade in Beltway ease, essentially it was more of a suggestion, more of a this is how the administration views these issues than actually binding an agency to act in a certain way, the way many executive orders over the last several administrations have been much more directed in terms of agency shell. This was more the agency is encouraged to consider. So it doesn't actually force the agency to come out any particular way. Now, the Surface Transportation Board is an independent federal agency, so they're less beholden to start with than, say, DOT would be. But they are certainly not immune to the political winds. They are certainly not immune to what the president's wishes are. and what the president's wishes are on these issues, I think it certainly has implications. It certainly lets the board know where the administration stands on consolidation, which when the agency has a merger proceeding before it is an interesting time for a statement like this to come out. It certainly puts the agency in a tough spot because it is not a traditional executive order. It is not the board shall, and the board can't really deny the merger on that basis. Now, I think, as we talked about earlier, I think it has the rules in place where if it wants to deny the merger, it can do that. I think the mergers are the rules, excuse me, are conducive to that. To coming in with a negative decision, having to go that way. But I think it certainly it adds a dynamic, and over the longer term, I think it gives more legs to proceedings like EP-711 on reciprocal switching that has languished at the board for over a decade now. It encourages the board to take that up and to take other measures like that up that are favorable to shippers and look at them through that lens. We have a board with a lot of new members on it. We're not sure where a lot of the members come down on some of these issues. This is certainly a nudge in the pro-shipper direction.
Yeah, no doubt. And as you said, languishing indeed, when we talk about the competitive reciprocal switching, I feel like it was 100 years ago when that first got broached, and we're still talking about it. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Before we wrap, Todd, I forgot to ask you, there was one question I overlooked, and just going back to rail service a few weeks back, the STB leadership was calling on leadership at the class ones for updated rail service reports. If it's not in my understanding, that's something that's requested every year, but this year it seemed a bit heightened, if you will, with STB pointing to a whole slew of different kind of service issues being cited by rail shippers. Am I being an alarmist here, or was there more to it than that?
No, I mean, I think it's a little bit of both. The board has historically asked the railroads to talk about their peak season plans for maintaining service levels.
Yeah.
Now, that was discontinued a couple of years ago. The fact that the board now wants to bring it back and bring it back as forcefully as it did, I think shows that there's some concern among members that the railroad's present service levels and that additional volumes could present further issues to service. So it certainly puts the carriers on notice that, you know, the regulators are watching and that they're concerned about rail service. And it certainly provides an additional incentive aside from the typical commercial incentives of, you know, increasing highway to rail conversions, you know, generating sticky customers. You know, the commercial incentive of the carriers, it presents a regulatory incentive for them to improve their service as quickly as they can.
Okay. Yeah. So that'll be something worth paying attention to as well. Well, Todd, look, this brings us to the end of our time for today's podcast. So on behalf of Logistics Management Magazine and also the Peerless Media Supply Chain Group, I'd like to offer up a big thank you for joining us today.
Well, of course. Thank you for having me, Jeff. My pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. Really, really good stuff here today that we discussed. For those of you on Twitter, please go ahead and give Todd a follow. It's simply at T Tranowski, FTR. And also give us a follow. It's simply at Logistics MGMT. And also, please feel free to subscribe to our podcast, where you can find it wherever you get podcasts. Just look for Supply Chain 24/7. That wraps it up for today, folks. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time. Have a great day.